This is a HeadGum Podcast.
You know, I am all about those little pick-me-ups throughout the day. Whether it's conquering work tasks or doing chores around the house, I need a little treat to reward me. It is a must. And you know what gets me smiling every time? Japanese snacks. Not only are they bursting with flavor, but the cute packaging and quirky vibes add an extra layer of fun. That is why teaming up with Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been an absolute delight. And these aren't your run-of-the-mill grocery store snacks, okay? Every month, Boxu brings you over 20 unique treats that you can normally find only in Japan. Plus, they throw in a nifty guide packed with info about each snack and Japanese culture. So you get to snack while you learn? Are you kidding? This was literally made for me. Oh, and by the way, each box ships straight from Japan, straight to your door. Okay, so I'm going to try one of the snacks for you. I got my little guide right here. I think this week I'm going to go for the Soka Senbei Uma Zurame. This senbei rice cracker boasts a uniquely irresistibly tart and sweet flavor combination of ume Japanese plum and zurame, a coarse granulated sugar. Cool. Now, this says it contains wheat and soy, so that's good to know for you gluten folks. There are plenty of gluten-free snacks in here. Here's the cracker. Ooh, this looks so good. Let me give it a try. Oh my God. You hear that crunch? It's like tart. It's a little salty. It's a little sweet. Mmm. This is delicious. Mmm. And I never would have gotten to try this if Boxu hadn't sent it straight to my house. Mm. And you know, my favorite thing about Boxu is that they support small family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced your treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love trying new and interesting things, or if you know somebody who does, you have got to try out Boxu and get these snacks shipped straight from Japan to your door. And right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's B-O-K-K-S-U.com.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's B-Y-T-E.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I don't know the truth. I don't know the way. I don't know what to think. I don't know what to say. Yeah, but that's all right. That's okay. I don't know anything.
Hello and welcome to Factually. I'm Adam Conover. Thank you so much for joining me on the show again. You know, you may have noticed that I spend a lot of time talking shit about the wealthy on this show. How they hoard their wealth, go to war against their own workers, and are in the process of destroying the planet all to protect their precious golden treasure. And I think a lot of you might feel the same way. That might be why you watch this show. And you're not alone. The American economy has gotten more and more unfair and frankly fucked up over the past 50 years, and people have taken notice. You don't need to be an economist to know that there's something bad about the top 10% of a society hoarding two-thirds of its wealth, or about a country where wages since 1979 have grown over five times faster for the top 1% than for the bottom 90%. As a result, in recent years, we have seen left-leaning social movements coalesce in order to fight this injustice. First, during the Occupy Wall Street movement, then in the 2016 presidential campaign of Bernie Sanders, and more recently in the emergence of groups like the Democratic Socialists of America. The word socialism is now a part of our political conversation in a way it simply wasn't in 2008 or 2000 or 1992. But while that's true, it still hasn't fully entered our political mainstream. You haven't seen a lot of socialist senators or even many members of the House yet. And here's the really weird part. The same is not true for the far right of our politics. I mean, the current GOP presidential candidate is open about wanting to cut the modest social safety net we do have, reducing Social Security and Medicare, lowering taxes on the rich and corporations, and gutting environmental regulations, all while enacting a wildly regressive, frankly fascist social agenda that will reduce the rights for women and target immigrants for deportation. I mean, I will grant that Bernie Sanders is very popular for a socialist in the context of American history. But there simply isn't a Bernie army the same way there is a MAGA army. There are 100 times as many elected MAGA leaders as socialists in American government today. Despite all of the left's successes, why is that? Well, to answer that question, we have an incredible guest on the show today. Before we get into it, though, I want to remind you that if you want to support this show and all the conversations we bring you, you can do so on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/Adam Conover. $5 a month gets you every episode of this show ad-free. And if you like stand-up comedy, please come see me on the road. This April, I'm going to be in Indianapolis, Indiana, San Jose, California, La Jolla, California, a bunch of other great places as well. Head to adamconover.net. for tickets and tour dates. And now, let's introduce today's guest. Bhaskar Sankara is president of The Nation magazine, the founding editor of Jacobin, and the author of a book called The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. Please welcome Bhaskar Sankara. Bhaskar, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I feel like it's long overdue because a lot of the issues that you write about in your work and that you cover are issues we've discussed on this show. And you know, you identify as a socialist and a leftist. I think that it's a really interesting time for those ideas in America, because on the one hand, you see them spreading or becoming more popular, in the public to some degree, in the policy, you know, apparatus to some degree. And yet the number of people, I saw a Pew Research study, the number of people who have positive views of socialism is going down and is much lower than people who have positive views of capitalism. You know, take those broad surveys for what they are. But it's sort of like, is this growing or is it not? How do you feel about the overall prospects for leftist politics and these policies in America right now?
Well, I think 10 years ago, you could say socialism in America as a current, even as an opposition movement, was basically dead. And now you could say it's on life support. It depends on your perspective. You know, if you're just,
I was like, oh, she's doing good. She's only in a coma now. We'll see what happens in a couple of years. Yeah,
exactly. So I think that for me, it feels fantastic. I became a card-carrying member of the Democratic Socialists of America. Not actually card-carrying, because they were too dysfunctional to actually get me a card at the time. In April 2007, there was about 5,000 of us, and wow. I was among the youngest members. I joined right before my 18th birthday. And today there's around 100,000 members of DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America. Jacobin, the socialist magazine I founded, has around, you know, 66,000 or so subscribers. You know, there is a base, and obviously between having Bernie Sanders as a self-identified Democratic Socialist, politicians like Alexander Ocasio-Cortez, there is a small amount of highly visible Democratic Socialists in public life. And that's not something we had in the recent past in the US. And in that sense, it's doing great. Now, is it ready to, you know, storm the barricades and really change American society in a fundamental way? You know, maybe not. But for a opposition movement that's just, you know, getting its legs, I'm not too disappointed.
Well, let's talk about Bernie Sanders, because, you know, when his first few campaigns, you know, they grew to such size, they ended up powering a movement. The movement continued in many ways, which resulted in the growth of the DSA. But if you contrast that with Donald Trump's movement, and I don't want to create an equivalency there, but there are some similarities. His movement has taken over an entire party. And has, you know, the Democratic Socialist movement, you can say, oh, there's a mayor over here. There's some state legislatures over there. You've got here in L.A., you know, we have, I believe, 3 city council people out of 15 who are members or at least associated with the DSA. Those are, you know, successes for the movement. But, you know, the MAGA movement, right, has representatives, senators, governors, et cetera. And hey, they don't win every election, yada, yada. But in terms of the way that it has been injected into the mainstream of American politics in this stunningly swift way is, you know, kind of in sharp contrast to what happened to the Bernie Sanders movement or the relative success. So what do you credit that to? Or do you think that the comparison I'm drawing is, you know, false entirely, which you may?
Well, I think that it's always easier to organize big money and you get some organic backing from ordinary people in the interest of capital. So fundamentally, Donald Trump's appeal was, I'm a businessman. I know how to make deals. I'm going to cut a better deal for you, ordinary American, and also for American business in the world. And I think that's an easier appeal to make than, you know, my name is Bernie Sanders. I'm an outsider. I want to take on millionaires and billionaires. Can you loan me $27 and I promise I'll spend your money well, fly economy, and, you know, travel around the country getting my message out. And I think that the Sanders route was a lot tougher. Trump was tapping into, I think, a continuum of Republican politics. We don't even think of it that way, but the Tea Party to Trump, I think, had common threads.
Of course.
And the hysteria that Trump whipped up around Obama's birth certificate was kind of part of tapping into that old Tea Party base, but radicalizing it. Then he was able to, with his own gifts as an orator, you know, he might not appeal to everyone, but he obviously is a skilled communicator in a certain way, and an entertainer, you know.
I mean, the guy will riff for 3 hours at a stretch about everybody he hates. And that's, you know, just as a stand-up comic, like, that's impressive. And the guy gets laughs, you know. It is a feat of oration, what he does.
And he has a cadence. He has, just as a performer, I think he has his skills. You know, Bernie always seems like he's a bit tired and fed up, which he is at this point. He has every right to be. But Trump was able to combine his natural gifts, this base that he had cultivated and radicalized a bit with the Obama birther stuff, and with a lot of his own money and a very hollowed out Republican party that he just knew how to pick apart. And by the time they realized that it was too late they needed to stop him, it was too late. Whereas the DNC realized they had to stop Bernie, but it wasn't too late. You know, the Obama was able to make a few calls, and Pete Buttigieg and Kamala Harris and others were able to, from their perspective, do the smart thing, rally behind Joe Biden. Joe Biden ended up winning the election. So on their own terms, they made a good decision, but they were unable to stop Trump. But I do think that maybe a stronger comparison to Trump would be, and I say this as someone who's generally a supporter of a lot of his policies, would be someone like AMLO in Mexico, who's been able to combine some of his oratory and charisma and somewhat strongman personality, but combine it with a genuinely progressive agenda. I think Bernie was always in the United States doing something a little bit different and a more difficult task given our context.
Yeah, draw that comparison a little bit more between AMLO, who in Mexico, like, and what Bernie did that's more difficult. Just pull that out some more.
Yeah, I think that, first of all, AMLO was someone who ran multiple times for president. He arguably won in 2006. He had the election, again, some people say stolen from him then, but either way, he was a very well-known national figure. He is someone who came from a lot of the historical networks of the left, but he figured out that he had to leave and abandon some of those networks and ways of talking and try to articulate a more populist framework for explaining who he was to the Mexican people and what his appeal was about. It was not just the regular left-wing appeals about redistribution and taking on the wealthy, but he combined it with this idea of fighting corruption and fighting to preserve the sanctity and purity of kind of Mexican republicanism in kind of a national popular sense. Bernie Sanders, in the same way, came from the hard left, really, in the United States. He was a member of the Young People's Socialist League, which just sounds incredibly anachronistic, as if anyone, all the people I know who are members of the Young People's Socialist League are like 85 years
old. Right, they're not young anymore. At the reunions, they're all on walkers, yeah.
And he joined in the left that was before the new left, really. Like, he was interested in this when he was at Brooklyn College and later on at the University of Chicago. So we're talking about pretty early on in the 1960s. I actually know a guy, I'm not sure he wants me to cite him, but he's like, he loves to tell me stories about this period because he was a leftist in the late 50s and the 60s. And often you can't really trust all of his stories, like he once told me. So then I told the Black Panther Party, your slogan shouldn't be Free Huey Newton. It should just be Free Huey. But so take this with a grain of salt, but okay. He did tell me he recruited Bernie Sanders to not just the Young People's Socialist League. And that, I think, is established fact that he did that at the University of Chicago. But he recruited him to the Shackmanite, a kind of Trotskyist oriented fraction of the Young People's Socialist League in the early 1960s. So Bernie was very steeply entrenched in the left.
I mean, Bernie, I used to do a joke on stage about how Bernie came to L.A. when he was running the second time. And he gave a speech about, you know, you should all be so proud you have the Dodgers, because we were all so sad in Brooklyn when the Dodgers moved to L.A. And I was like, wow, that's the moment I realized he was too old to be president. Like, you can't go around telling people that you remember when the Dodgers left Brooklyn. Like, that is the oldest school thing possible. That's like history books have been written about this. So he's steeped in that sort of like mid-century America in this very specific way.
Yeah, and exactly. I think that was part of his strength, because he both left behind that existing left, or he moved to Vermont in a place that he could really find a way to influence politics at a bigger scale. Yeah. But he kept a lot of its allegiance to the old bread and butter, simple way of talking about things. And then often when people say that, that could be a euphemism for, let's not talk about gay people, let's not talk about racial justice and so on. But, you know, Bernie Sanders is a product of the new left. You know, he's a product of the civil rights movement. He's someone who went to Vermont to try to farm, which is kind of just a crazy thought in and of itself, the kind of back to the land movement. You would think they would maybe pick somewhere a little bit more fertile than his book.
I always wondered how he got to Vermont from Brooklyn. He literally, it was part of like the back to the land, like let's start a little homestead in New England hippie movement.
I'm not sure if he intended to like survive by farming, but it was definitely let's get a cabin, let's get a little land.
Wow.
And in his book, the same book where he talks kind of about, you know, the New York trolley dodgers or whatever, the Brooklyn trolley dodgers leaving town and him getting upset. You know, he also talks about surviving that first winter, which was one of the worst winters for, you know, in modern history in terms of temperature and whatnot, and not having proper heat and trying to, you know, find enough to burn to stay warm. So, you know, he obviously has a little bit of that hippy dippy left in him. But he had a very simple message, and he said the same thing in his first run in the early 1970s for office, all the way up to his 2016 run, which was millionaires control too much of this country's wealth. He would give the same percentage. X percentage of people control Y percentage of the wealth. Same right. Framing, same syntax. And in a way, I think the very old, somewhat mid-century New York ethnic accent combined with that straight talk, I think it resonated, you know, deeply in a lot of people. It made somewhat radical ideas seem accessible, comprehensible.
Yeah, and it made him seem authentic. This guy's been saying the same thing. It made it clear that he was authentic, honestly, that this guy has been saying these same things for the last 50 years. He comes by it honestly, and, you know, we can take him at his word. But to your point about and I don't want to spend the entire time, you know, relitigating the last couple of elections. But, you know, you're correct that there was a concerted effort by the Democratic Party to beat him, because Obama and that wing of the party thought that Bernie couldn't win. And, you know, they teamed up to, you know, consolidate and beat him. And I've heard that narrative before, talking to, you know, folks in the DSA, folks who are big Bernie supporters. Bernie got screwed by the Democratic Party. But, you know, there were also people trying to screw Trump, maybe not as well. And you do at some point like have to win, right? Like, you know, Bernie's argument, or the argument of a lot of Bernie supporters, were, well, Bernie would have beaten Trump. But OK, and would have beaten him the first time as well in the Hillary Clinton election. And OK, that's a hypothetical, but a good piece of support for the hypothetical would be if he had won the primary. If you want to prove that your political movement has the goods, has the juice to like sweep the entire country, then it would be helpful to win the primary first, you know? And Bernie had a lot of support, but it's like, hey, was it just that Obama screwed it? Well, Obama might not have been able to do that if he had had massively more support than he did whereas Trump, you know, a thought that I have is, you know, you said Trump is running on the thing of being a billionaire, et cetera, or a very wealthy man who can make business deals. He was also running on pure hate, right? Just like powering of there are people out there who are trying to screw you. There's people coming over the border. There's people you hate. I'm going to take vengeance on them. And so part of what I wondered is like, is that not currently in where we are in American politics, maybe just more powerful? Is there more support for that than for socialism and you know, what Bernie and folks like you are asking folks to support?
So I think it's worth keeping in mind. Well, first of all, let's concede. Yeah, my view is that Bernie lost the election, and he lost because in 2016, he wasn't recognizable. He wasn't considered credible until all of a sudden his message resonated. By then, mm-hmm. It was almost too late. So I think if he had started with his momentum against Clinton earlier, I think he would have credibly won. There was nothing the DNC could have done to stop him. He just got out of the gate a little bit slow, in part because, you know, this was always meant to be something of a protest candidacy. And I think he was surprised by how seriously he took Houston.
But if his 2016 campaign had been his second campaign, not his first, things might have been different.
Yeah, and I think in his second campaign, I think by then the Democratic field was just broken up into so many different camps. And it just happened to be that the Bernie camp was the largest of these many polarized camps. But the Democrats had something that Obama, the Republicans didn't have, which was a big unifying figure that could unite the other camps. And ultimately, it wasn't just a backdoor deal that Obama cut. It was a deal connected to various constituencies. And I think for a lot of, let's say, Black voters, particularly older Black voters in the South, in South Carolina, they voted for Biden because their primary goal was to find someone who they thought was electable and find someone who they thought could beat Trump. And I think the rational kernel of it is not that Biden's policies would have been better in a vacuum from Bernie's policies, but that you know, Biden was electable and they would bear the brunt of another Trump presidency. So in that case, it's a bunch of different actors acting pretty rationally. And I was a Bernie national surrogate in 2020. I chalk it up as, you know, just losing, you know, losing the game of politics. And if there was a backroom way for the Bernie-crats to win, I would have loved to pursue that backroom way.
Yeah, that's politics is making the phone calls, knowing the people, knowing, hey, this person, we have to gotta get this person and their constituency on our side. Like, you can't wish that away. You have to sort of win that process to some degree. So, I mean, do you think that, sorry, please go on.
No, but as far as your question on, is there a stronger constituency for hate in the U.S. or for Trump's sort of vitriolic appeals and for the Bernie appeals? I would say that when it comes to redistribution, you know, it might be a wash. There might be a lot, half the country hoping for more redistribution in the abstract, half the country still betting that they're going to strike it rich. So maybe let's hold off on this redistribution stuff. I know I'm way behind on my mortgage and I'm in medical debt, but, you know, I'm one good move away from being wealthy. Of course, there's some aspect of that. But when you compare America to, let's say, Western Europe, I think you would find that Americans are, one, more welcoming of immigrants than a lot of countries in Western Europe. So Americans, for example, even a lot of people who vote for Trump, one, they vastly overestimate the amount of undocumented immigration the United States has. But more generally, therefore, higher amounts of legal immigration and therefore tightening the border at the same time. So, which is very different than some of the xenophobic appeals in Europe. A vast majority of Americans are for things like birthright citizenship. My parents came to the U.S. in 1988. I was born in 1989. I would imagine that maybe not as commanding of a majority as it was in the past, but probably a majority of Republicans would agree that I have a right to be a U.S. Citizen. That's not the case in a lot of European countries. And most of those countries don't have birthright citizenship like we have throughout most of the Western hemisphere. On a host of other issues, I think you'll find that Americans as a whole, especially young people, hold more progressive views than their peers in the advanced capitalist world and in Europe and even Japan, South Korea. This is a good starting point for us from progressive politics. And I think that we shouldn't let Trump's appeal maybe make us too pessimistic about where most Americans are on these issues.
Yeah, I agree, because and I think that is what makes this contrast so interesting to me, is that you feel the groundswell of support for these issues. I mean, you know, it's literally just here on YouTube. When I put in the title of something, billionaires, capitalism, right? I get more views when I do that, right? Because the audience is like, oh my God, yes, someone is saying the thing that I want to hear, right? Like I can tell that there's an undercurrent. That's my job sort of as a comedian and broadcaster, to know how people are feeling and to make things that speak to that, that also line up with what I personally believe. I can sense that undercurrent, as can so many other people. And the contrast between it and the electoral success is like somewhat fascinating. You see all these positive signs, but you also see, well, hold on a second. Why aren't politicians who espouse some of these policies doing better? But before we get deeper into that, I'd love, actually, I think we waited a little too long in the podcast to do this. When you talk about socialism and democratic socialism, do you have a capsule summary of what you mean by that? Because I don't want to, you know, people are maybe filling in the blank of what they believe that your political beliefs or project is.
Well, fundamentally, to me, socialism is about, at a minimum, securing people's social and economic necessities and saying that people are entitled to certain things just by virtue of being born. So At the very least, that means the state as a provider of last resort for things like, healthcare, childcare, housing, you know, nutrition. So making sure we have that baseline of a welfare state. Secondly, to me, it's about extending democracy from purely the formal political realm into the economic realm as well. So if we were to agree that democracy is a good thing at the ballot box, why shouldn't we have greater degrees of democracy at our workplace? And within those two broad sets of principles, I think you could have a lot of different forms. So I don't suppose that a centrally planned economy would be a great system to live under. You know, I think there's certain both incentive and informational problems that arise in those systems.
Yeah,
but you could still have markets where you have an employee-owned or worker owners controlling their workplaces and competing with each other to produce goods and services, and a private sector for consumer goods and services, while also having a larger state sector that secures things like healthcare or, you know, some of the big what economists would call natural monopolies, like our, you know, railroad network or things like that, where we feel like maybe it would be fine for there to just be one actor in this sphere, and we'd rather not it be a giant corporate actor. We'd rather have the state where, in theory, we have greater scope to control the realm of state action. So as a democratic socialist, part of what I believe in is, in a sense, a reconciliation of liberalism and socialism. So, for example, I think rights are great. And it's great to have this idea that, yes, democracy is excellent in most spheres of life, but there are certain things where I don't want my neighbor intruding on my personal consumption choice. I don't want my neighbor or the majority restricting on my ability to speak freely or to do my own thing. And I think those are great aspects of liberalism. And I think they're perfectly reconcilable with a socialism that tries to secure people's rights to develop into individuals that can truly reach their potentials and can participate in our society. Because, you know, right now I think we take for granted as Americans that a kid born in, you know, Fairfield, Connecticut is going to have a radically different life and life outcomes and opportunities as a kid born, you know, 20, 30 miles away in Hartford or Waterbury. Right. And I'm doing very Connecticut examples. Not even from Connecticut.
Oh, everybody is aware of the socioeconomic strata of different Connecticut cities and towns. I think we all know this. No, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about like where I grew up on Long Island versus Brownsville, Brooklyn, right? Or what? Pick your neighborhood where you're like, oh yeah, that's the bad part of town. And this is the good part of town. Right.
Yeah, we just and take for granted that, you know, some kids going to public schools in some neighborhoods. We're not even like Britain where, yeah, of course, we ship people out to fancy boarding schools are going to have different outcomes. But public schools, we take for granted that some of them are going to produce doctors and lawyers and engineers, and other schools are going to produce dropouts. And that's not normal for a rich country where we could easily solve that problem, not even through socialist revolution, but through tax and transfers and investments and jobs programs and a host of other things.
Yeah, I thought your answer was interesting there because you sort of gave us the entire scope all the way from the minimal to the maximal version of socialism. You ended by talking about, you know, a substantially different economic system that had has a lot more state action, worker cooperatives that are competing with each other. We could dive into that. But you also had, on the other hand, you know, talking about simply expanded social welfare programs of the kind that we're already used to. Like we already provide in America many of the types of programs that you're talking about. We have, you know, a somewhat socialized version of education. We have public school K through 12. We do not have that for higher education. And, you know, we could talk about ways that we could expand for public education so that your zip code does not determine how much, you know, that we don't fund public schools via property taxes, meaning wealthier areas have better schools. And what I find really interesting is that in the last couple years, we have tested a lot of the most immediate socialist ideas, if we want to label them that way. During the pandemic, there was massively increased, welfare payment or welfare payments of general kinds to folks during the pandemic. We had expanded, tax credits, child welfare, et cetera, unemployment benefits, and those had huge beneficial impacts on people's lives that then a couple of years later were removed. Also, going back to the 2020 election, when Joe Biden came into office, he at least acted as though, he was going to be much more of a, I don't want to say a socialist, but he was proclaiming himself sort of the next coming of FDR, right? He was going to do New Deal style stuff. And he did some of it, giant infrastructure spending, et cetera, antitrust enforcement. Those were all things that I expected an Elizabeth Warren or a Bernie Sanders president to do, not a Joe Biden. It feels on the policy level, holy shit, some of these things have become not impossible in America, even if we're not sure if they're going to stick around. Do you have any view on that?
Yeah, I think that one interesting, first of all, I think that the infrastructure bill was a positive development. You know, it was like over $1 trillion of funding for roads, bridges, mass transit, rail service. Like, obviously, that's better than what we would have gotten from a Trump administration. Obviously, there's it's a policy success. But I guess that sometimes the United States, the reason why a lot of Americans feel like, oh, well, we're already trying massive socialist style spending in the U.S. and we already have this massive welfare state, but it just doesn't work, is because we tend to have quite inefficiently designed programs. So when we do spend money, let's say on welfare, we needlessly mean test it, and we waste time and resources, and we weaken these programs by saying you have to be this poor to use it. Not only that, it does create real incentives and disincentives, and it creates resentment towards, let's say, if you want to use this category, it's kind of a made-up category, but the lower middle class feels like, oh, well, I'm struggling, or the working poor feels like I'm struggling, but I don't qualify for something that I would qualify for if I just worked a little bit less. And right. You end up dividing up working class people that have a vested interest in protecting a lot of the same programs. And And those people who might be working and might not qualify, for example, for Medicaid, would benefit from living in a community because they already live in these areas with their neighbors who are able to access good healthcare and things like that. So it's both the design of the programs isn't great, and often we tend to create programs where we allow prices, corporations to push prices sky high for certain things like healthcare. And our solution to the problem is by subsidizing the poorest so they're able to access this market, but we're doing nothing to address the cost of things. So with education, we're doing this, higher education, and with healthcare, whereas in other more statified systems, you're able to find ways to more radically reduce cost. And that's the reason why we spend a larger percentage of our GDP on healthcare than other countries like even the UK, which has a system more expansive than Medicare for All, our main demand of the United States, but an entire national health service. So, yeah, I often think that even things that the Build Back Better kind of what emerged out of it and what actually got passed, the infrastructure bill, I question the design of some of those things. Like, are we just subsidizing willy-nilly a lot of green companies? Sure, I'd rather subsidize them than other forms of capital, but are we actually controlling the outcomes of these subsidies, or are we just throwing money at things?
Right. Are we just giving money to more corporations that, you know, we like maybe a little bit better, but we're not like getting at the root of the problem?
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Staying on healthcare for a second, so many times when we describe, hey, here's what they do in Europe, here's how they organize a system, or here's how we could tweak our current subsidies to make them better, et cetera, we're talking about improvements that just in literal fact would be better, right? Like when we talk about the American healthcare system, we can go down this list of it's so expensive. It's expensive because of multiple insurance companies and because the capitalist incentive. If we had a single payer system, we would have better health outcomes. Everything would be cheaper. And this is being done around the globe. It's sort of like incontrovertibly better in every way. And yet in the United States, what is, you know, should almost be, hey, there's an asteroid headed towards Earth. Let's look at it. It's up there. This is real. You know, we know this for a fact, becomes a political position that rises and falls in popularity. And, you know, I'll say right now, Medicare for All, that is the socialist and the sort of Bernie movement ask. It's also sort of faded in popularity again in our politics. It's less a part of our politics than it was 5 years ago. It's such a strange state of affairs that, again, a single payer system, better in every way. Anyone who dives into the data, it's very hard to argue that it wouldn't be. It's very hard to defend the current system. And yet it seems so far from us being able to implement what's like truly a common sense reform. Why do you think that is? And what do you think the prospects are in the future for that kind of program?
Well, I think in this case, what's interesting is you have a chunk of the American public that is already covered under a single payer system, be it retirees and also the poor and veterans as well, who are covered through the VA in an underfunded system, but a system that's closer to the British NHS than anything else. So that chunk of Americans are already covered by socialized medicine. Then you have a chunk of Americans who have stable jobs. Either they're lucky enough to have the old union jobs and be a part of that 10% of the economy that's covered under union contracts, or they're manager or professionals or others who have stable healthcare. So then you have to kind of go down the list until you find people who are getting really squeezed by the current system. Now, the new system would be better for a lot of people. One, if we retain current spending for Medicaid and Medicare, then we would, in a system where we're better able to control costs, we could actually provide more services under Medicare, Medicaid. If we had employers no longer responsible for healthcare, then workers in America would be able to use that extra bargaining power to demand not just the platinum healthcare benefits or their employers to pay for their HRAs or these other tax-deferred programs like FSAs and HSAs. If anyone's listened to this from the UK, they'll probably just think we're insane with these acronyms, but this is how complicated our system is. But they'd be able to use that bargaining power that's often spent by unions talking about these private market benefit schemes and actually use it towards wages or hours worked or conditions or something more bread and butter. So a lot of people would benefit from the new system, but if they feel like they're getting enough from the current system, and if they're also in a perverse way, maybe benefiting from the fact that there's 20, 25 million people who are essentially either not insured or who are unable to access their benefits because of how high the deductibles are, they have the advantage of having, let's say, shorter wait times than in other systems. It doesn't really equal that because in practice, you'd always encourage more doctors to join. And if people are worried about, in single payer systems, you could see your primary care physician right away. But if you want to see a specialist, it's sometimes longer, or sometimes the state kind of does its own triage where if you really need to see a specialist, you'll see one tomorrow. But if you need to see, you know, a dermatologist for a cosmetic skin condition, then you might have to wait 3-4 weeks.
Right.
That sort of thing. You could just pay specialists more in the system. You could find ways to fix this, but I think that the constituency that really is materially motivated to go out there and to change U.S. healthcare is actually not that massive unless we have a politician, a movement articulating the benefits in a clear and concise way, like Bernie did. The entire Bernie campaign, many of the people I know doing work around Medicare for All were already insured by good and employer sponsored plans. So it wasn't just self-interest. I think it was about tying it to a broader vision of change and taking on a really powerful forces, you know, that the medical industry.
Well, it's not just the medical industry, though. It's also like a lot of the public has a vested interest in the current system. You mentioned unions, which would not have, you know, unions in the United States generally bargain for health care. And, you know, they have to spend like maybe one out of every three cycles. Oh, we got to make sure we shore up our health insurance plan. We got to make sure the plan is really good. And hey, if there was state sponsored health insurance, they wouldn't have to do so. Right. They could just focus on wages instead. That argument's true. And yet many unions have not supported Medicare for All because, you know, the members think, well, hold on a second. I have great health care now. I don't know what this plan would be like. Maybe it would be worse. There's a huge education hurdle, but then also sometimes the leadership of the unions is like, well, healthcare is what we provide. Like that is why people are excited to be a member of the union is because they get the healthcare. So if we don't give healthcare, how do we know that we can get, you know, our members to show up, you know, if we need to go on strike, et cetera, maybe they won't need us as much anymore. And so those are, and by the way, those are ways that, you know, good people, you know, in good faith in the movement can end up, the incentives push them in that direction. And so it seems like there's still, even though it all pencils out right, there are sort of institutional barriers, even in folks who, you know, you would think that as a socialist, you would be in, you know, in the movement with folks in the labor movement. It's like an internal tension there.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think that there's a lot of unions who basically don't trust the government to create a plan as good as what their members enjoy now, or at least they feel like the union members feel that way in the private sector. I think there's also some other unions that are afraid that if there's a continued push to make union membership volunteer, so kind of open shops instead of closed shops, that having kind of access to health insurance and people get accessing those plans through their union membership is a potentially really important part of keeping people in unions. But I think these are ultimately pretty short-sighted. I also think it's short-sighted for U.S. industry as a whole, particularly, let's say, the U.S. auto industry that's competing with, historically competing with labor in Japan and in Germany, you know, places that the state plays a much bigger role in health provision, but are, you know, kind of at a competitive disadvantage. I think the counter is that employers like having this major benefit that everybody needs tied to employment because it keeps people at their firms. And again, they make the calculation that it may be the control that they get over workers, and this leverage is more important than the savings. But I think there's a host of small businesses and others that would benefit from not having this this burden.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that it's short-sighted. It's a sort of short-term or current benefit that some of these actors currently enjoy, but that is preventing them from a greater long-term benefit. And yeah, I'm just curious from your view, how do we make progress on it? You said, you know, it sort of needs a leader like Bernie spreading the message. But Bernie did the best job of it anyone's done in 30 years. And, you know, again, it, you know, the wave rolled in, but then, you know, went back. And so are there, you know, in terms of this, just looking at socialized medicine, how does one build progress towards that over the next few decades?
So the reason why I keep mentioning Bernie as someone who's obviously my politics are probably a step or two to Bernie's left in certain ways. And I was a member of the socialist movement way before the first Bernie campaign in 2015, 2016. But I keep mentioning him because I think that we're in such a hollowed out political environment that we actually need big national politics and politics at the level of communications and politics at the level of almost like a national kind of populist articulation, the way that Trump provides it on the right. And I think Bernie for a time is providing it on the left to break through this hollowed out environment, to break through and to re-engage people with politics. So in the 2016 campaign, you saw for the first time Trump and Bernie both rallying people by the tens of thousands.
Yeah,
it was displays that obviously there was a little bit of this in Obama's 2008 run, but it's something that reminds you of politics in another country, not politics as we've known it growing up in the United States.
Yeah. Arena rallies for political candidates. That's not something that people were doing for Al Gore.
Definitely. Or it'd be like a once a year, you know, they'll just do it at the right. DNC. You remember he did the weird thing where he kind of rebuffed Bill Clinton a little bit and aggressively made out with his wife, Al Gore.
I don't remember that, but I'm going to look it up after this show.
It was kind of a like, I'm Al Gore and I love my wife. You know, yeah, that guy doesn't love his wife.
I'm a wife guy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, I think that in this environment that's so hollowed out, one, it means that even a group as small as Democratic Socialists of America or other small groups like Justice Democrats or Sunrise can actually make a difference because, and on the other side, obviously, the anti-abortion activists and the Christian right can kind of make a huge difference, too. With a small group of highly motivated organizers in a hollowed out political environment can have disproportionate influence. But I think that the goal of campaigns like the Sanders campaign has to be to spur people out of this malaise then get them motivated and activated and give them a language that they could use, a framework they could use, a set of demands that they could identify with. Where Bernie failed was that he wasn't successfully able to carry on his campaign, even in a limited form, through some permanent organs. So in other words, he tried to do Our Revolution, which kind of went nowhere. And he tried to do these other efforts to make his campaign permanent. But that's not something he was particularly good at. So it was up to us on the far left to build organizations like the Democratic Socialists of America. Whereas I think that socialist politics in America is obviously what I believe in. I think it's important. But I think there's probably a broader base for egalitarian pro-working class politics in America that uses probably is more ideologically diffuse and also uses a different sort of language than the socialist left does in the United States, but that fundamentally stands for a fairer deal for working class people and stands for defense and expansion of important social programs like Medicare for All.
When you say a different sort of language than the socialist left, what do you mean, than the current socialist left?
Well, I think the socialist left right now, we are activists, but without a huge social base. So a lot of us come from working class backgrounds, and a lot of us are involved in campaigns that do connect with a lot of working class people. Like, for example, there's a lot of DSA members who are actively involved in tenant rights struggles that do have an important base. But fundamentally, we join DSA in ones and twos. So we often create a hot house where certain language and ideological distinctions that are not really that important or consequential to people's lives day to day take on greater consequence.
Right. A lot of people reading books and getting very heated about them in closed door meetings is what you're talking about.
Yeah, but I wish the meetings were closed doors.
So sometimes they go viral, yeah. When the internecine arguments, yeah.
And again, I think building a base of cadre who think about some of these more theoretical points, or are committed or keep alive some of this old language, I actually think is useful in certain ways. But if you're not connected to a real social base, you're not challenged to try to articulate your ideas in a way every single day. In a way that wins over ordinary Americans and all their complexities, the Yang to Trump to back to Yang to now RFK Jr. Curious Teamster, like literally someone I spoke to yesterday.
So, right.
Who's a person of color, by the way, which makes it, I think that's a lot of this election, because even a lot of our priors about Hispanic voters and others with vis-a-vis Trump, like, is not going to be true in this election either. And the RFK Jr. factor is something that I personally just have not considered much until recently. Mm-hmm. Now it just seems like he's not going to go away and he's going to get his 15%, and maybe I'm just hoping only 8 of those 15 will be from Biden and the rest will be from Trump.
You think he's going to get 15? You think RFK is going to get 15% of the popular vote?
I think that, I think polling would have him close to that. I think in reality, as we get closer to the election, it'll become more and more polarized. I think that RFK vote will dissipate back to both Trumps. Probably 55% of it might go to Biden. The rest will go to Trump. I think that the best bet, I'm one of the few people, and I feels like the few people in the world that just thinks that Biden's going to win, if only because I feel like he's been hit so hard with all these negatives for so many months that it's only going to go up from here.
Yeah.
And Trump, between his legal trouble and between just the sheer amount of vitriol that a portion of Americans have for him, I just feel like the negative polarization, as people like to call it, of the race will skew in Biden's favor, because we've already lived through Trump and we have, I think, concerns that the next 4 years of Trump would be even worse. And I just feel like that's the thing that'll motivate people who are quite discontent with Biden, like myself, to vote for him. And I would vote for Biden if I was in a swing state. You know, I'm in New York, so I'll vote for Jill Stein or something. You know why I vote for Jill Stein?
Why?
Jill Stein asked me, "Hey, Bhaskar, are you going to vote for me in 2016? I'm like, "Man, no one else hit me up." You know, I'm not sure if it's an effective way to win a national, you know, campaign.
She personally asked you.
Yeah.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
You were talking about somebody who speaks to an actual group of working people. That reminds me of, say, Sean Fain, who is saying, you know, a lot of those ideas, why do we even have billionaires, et cetera, things that maybe Bernie could have said or that a DSA leader would say, but he's saying them to his actual members who he understands, he knows them well, and he's trying to get them to go on strike or sign a union card or whatever it is. And that's like really rooted to their struggle. It's not, you know, someone like myself at a DSA meeting with a college education saying, "Hey, here's what I think would be good for some people who I haven't met," for example. And that's a real difference that is meaningful, perhaps. Going back to the national election, though, there were people who said the same thing that you just said. "I'll vote for Jill Stein because I'm pretty sure that Biden's going to win." You did say you'd vote for him if you lived in a swing state, but there were people who said similar things in 2016, and other people were very mad at them because everyone thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. And hey, I can just, you know, I can do whatever I want, right? For that reason. I think this year, something that is really going to give Biden a lot of trouble is what's happening in Gaza right now, the support for Israel, et cetera. And it strikes me that this has been such a wedge through the entire left. You had DSA members writing an open letter about why they're leaving DSA because of da 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 go down. You know, they wrote, the DSA national leadership put out a message that was et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You've had this happen at leftist groups, at meetings throughout the country, in local Democratic parties, et cetera. I've heard a lot of people say, "Hey, this is regardless of how you feel about that, we are talking about, you know, we're talking about America's economic needs, right? And building socialism in America. This is a, you know, maybe this is not a distraction because we are a part of what's happening in Israel, but it's a very, it's such a wrench to be thrown in at such a vulnerable moment." I'm curious to get into that piece of it. How do you think that Israel's offensive against the civilians in Gaza has affected your movement?
Well, I think among DSA, if anything, having the focal point of solidarity work with Palestine has been a uniting factor in the organization as a whole. I think there are some older members who objected to some of the rhetoric used right after the October 7th attacks. And I think their argument was basically, you're using rhetoric that is preemptively condemning Israel for the response, rather than focusing on the actual attack, in which hundreds of civilians died. And also you're using rhetoric in some cases that maybe it was more appropriate to national liberation movements in the 60s and 70s than it is to an Islamist group like Hamas. I think that obviously I try to aim for some of the, you know, in general, try to aim for a broad-based rhetoric that tries to speak beyond the converted. So I think there's probably some truth in that and some of the initial communications. But as a whole, I think in a moral and ethical sense, I think DSA kind of got it right, which is that there was definitely going to be a huge and disproportionate Israeli response on a largely civilian population. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the Democratic Party, particularly younger Democrats, much less the far left, are united in thinking that Israel's actions have been disproportionate, that it's targeted civilians, and that there needs to be an immediate ceasefire. I think you're even hearing those sorts of things in tepid ways from the Biden administration itself or from figures within the State Department, which is shows a pretty wide spectrum of belief.
Yes.
Now, I do think that Biden hasn't exhibited the courage that he needed to. I think he's done just enough that history won't say that he was Netanyahu. And I think that's honestly been his goal. He's been probably thinking to himself, well, I don't want to spend enough capital to end this, because the last time I spent a lot of capital on a foreign policy issue, his correct decision to withdraw from Afghanistan, I got so much flack for it, but I also don't want people to think I'm Netanyahu. So I'm going to do like the hot mic moment, which I actually think was a hot mic moment, but it might as well have been staged at the State of the Union.
This is where he was like, oh man, Bibi's got to cut that out, man, or whatever, like to somebody off the mic. Yeah.
Well, and he managed to just make it as awkward as possible because he's Biden. So he's talking about a Jewish prime minister. So he's like, I need to have a come to Jesus moment for Bibi.
Is there a Jewish counterpart to the phrase come to Jesus? Neither of us are the ones to answer that question, but I'm curious. Anyway, please go on.
No, but I think that that hopefully as time goes on, that those efforts accelerate and there is some sort of resolution. But I think this is something that history will really condemn Biden and his administration for. I think that you could count in the thousands of lives the amount of people that would have been saved if Biden had acted sooner. And again, even from the narrow standpoint of Israeli defense, I don't think there's a credible argument that killing several thousand more civilians in the operation is going to make Israel safer, as opposed to continuing, you know, the conflict in perpetuity. And that being said, I actually am not of the opinion that Biden's actions will be a decisive factor in the race in November 2024. I think
really,
and I say this with you know, using my words carefully. I don't think this is a good thing, but I do think that a lot of voters, if the Israeli assault ends in the next month or two, a lot of voters will kind of move on by then. And again, I don't think they should, you know, especially with 30,000+ people dead. But I think they will move on from them. The news cycle will move on, like we've seen time and time again in these sorts of cases. And also the real politique will overwhelm people. And some of this is very rational. You know, we choose once every 4 years not who we want to be in charge in a positive sense, but we often have to choose who we, for on the far left, who we want to be in opposition to. Or, you know, for ordinary people, like who's the lesser evil. And I think that for a lot of people, that's going to be Joe Biden. And I think among a lot of voters in places like Michigan, I think they're going to feel the pressure to vote for Biden. I think given the constraints of our political system, it makes perfect sense that those people would vote for Biden. Then again, I do feel like the credible threat of exit is an important way to actually influence mainstream Democratic Party politicians. And that's a tension. That's a balancing act between listening to people's concerns about a second presidency, but also wanting to be oppositional enough that we could actually be a pressure group from the outside. And I think that DSA members at an individual level in the organization has tried to do that balancing act. And sometimes I think they don't get enough credit for how well they're doing that. I think the DSA no endorsement is in and of itself not allowing members to do what they want and to make their own decisions. And the vast majority of those members will vote for Biden in swing states, but it also maintains DSA as a credible oppositional force in a Democratic Party that really does need one, and an American civil society that does need one.
I really appreciate your description of it as a balancing act, because there's a constant tension between, you know, when if folks say, I can never vote for Biden because of his support for Netanyahu or the United States' material support to Israel. Well, that's something that you have to accept. And yet you're like, well, hold on a second. There are two alternatives here. And, you know, we don't want the worse of the two. But if you go vote blue, no matter who, then you remove the ability to put any pressure on. So you do need to find, like, both things are true at once, and you need to find a middle between them. And I agree that I have seen some DSA groups, I think, being sophisticated politically in how they handle it. I guess my broader concern, when, you know, apart from my deep concern for everybody in that region for the citizens of Gaza when all of that went down, and my concern about those specific policies, was the left has a reputation and a history of splintering throughout groups, not limited to DSA, throughout its history. And I saw splintering happen just in my own political waters here in Los Angeles. Splintering occurred. People who had previously been in coalition in the movement with each other suddenly said, I can never fuck with those people again. And, you know, on both sides of that. And, you know, if you are interested in political change and you understand, hey, that requires everyone to get on the same side, or everyone to push in the same direction, regardless of your feelings of the actual policy, like, to see the splintering can be difficult and lamentable. And so I'm curious how you think about that broader issue within left politics of, you know, backbiting. People will complain about purity testing. I don't really like that phrase, but that's a common complaint that you hear, et cetera. That sort of perennial problem, and how can the left overcome it?
Well, I think that the splintering is pretty common in a lot of like-minded ideological groups, or mm-hmm. even just groups in general. We just happen to live in society where there isn't that much organized activity anymore. This is the old kind of Putnam, like, bowling alone description of how hollowed out our social lives and our society.
This book has come up on this show so many times. At some point, I gotta get he's not dead, is he? I gotta get him on the show to talk about it, because it's come up over and over again.
I think Robert Putnam is still around, but he must be pretty old by this point.
The book's a couple decades old.
Yeah, he's around. I take credit. I don't take credit. Jacobin, I think, should take some credit for its resurrection, because we published a few articles about it a couple issues ago. So I think we got some of the left talking about it. But if you look at the history of the American political right, if you look at the history of religious groups, especially, a lot of the words we use to describe the left, like sectarianism, like, well, where does this come from? This comes from the million different splits of religious groups into sectarian groups. And I think in general, that, like, it's something that I personally like to avoid. I like to try to be ecumenical, but have my beliefs, but figure out how do you create a box where we could have different ideas and have contestation within that box. But like you said, still move together in the same direction. And that's different than a line, you know. A box has room for, you know, eclectic decisions and debates over tactics and strategy. But as long as you figure out here are five core principles. Here's where we're aligned on, then we can move forward. I think sometimes when it comes to, you know, an issue like Israel, Palestine, I think if our demand right now is ceasefire now, I think that is a pretty broad demand that can incorporate a lot of different voices, including liberal Zionists and others. Everyone from liberal Zionists to revolutionaries to people who believe in democratic one state. I think we can all be in that tent together, and we could decide, you know, debate 67 versus 48 versus, you know, one state solution, you know, some other time or within that tent. But I actually think that the left in general has done a pretty good job and being led by groups like the Solidarity Movement. A lot of the great actions have been by groups like Jewish Voices for Peace that have used, I think, really inclusive rhetoric and have talked about the fact that, you know, their core members are Jewish Americans, and here's why they're concerned by Israel's actions. And I think, again, that's different than having a left that was so pure that said, you know, you can't say one word about Israeli civilians, or you can't say one word about, you know, two states or whatever. And if you say that, you can't be part of our ceasefire now movement. If it was like that, then I would say that we're in a really a moment that's too sectarian. I think that for now, the rhetoric, I think, is very good. The demand is broad. And also the rhetoric is about our basic human values. It's about the right of, you know, children to have access to nutrition and people to not be under siege and against collective punishment, you know, things that I think are really broad. But going back to, you mentioned Sean Fain before, and I think that part of his appeal is that he's both a leader in the labor movement. He's both someone with a huge base of support through the UAW with ordinary working class people, but also he draws on his Christian values when he talks about his socialist values, when he talks about being an egalitarian, and when he talks about where wealth comes from and how the fruits of one's labor should be distributed. And I think that's really powerful. And when I think about what kind of left-wing rhetoric can actually reach 100, 200 million Americans, I would imagine it sounds something like that.
I agree with that. And looking forward is how I'd like to end here. You open by saying, over the last 10 years, moved from socialism being dead to being on life support. First of all, that's pretty impressive because a resurrection happened in the middle there, which is a miracle. So let's say that's an accomplishment for your movement. I would love for you to paint a picture of 10 years from now, right? Because you've said, hey, we need these charismatic leaders. I don't see someone stepping up in electoral politics to take the Bernie Sanders crown currently. No one is running for president this year with that sort of overtly socialist politics. And by the way, DSA membership, I've read, has slightly declined or at least plateaued for a little bit. So in terms of growth, after we've seen a lot of growth in the last 10 years, how does the movement continue growing, and where do you see it in your rosiest view?
Well, my rosiest view, I think that a lot of the younger people who move left on key issues, we could connect with them and get them to engage in politics. And we connect with them. We tell them, you know, engaging with politics isn't just about having a persona online or having a set of likes and dislikes, but actually being involved in a union. And if you're in a workplace that is unionized or can be unionized, it's getting involved in your local community. It's either connecting with groups like DSA or Jewish Voices for Peace, some of the far left groups that I you know, mentioned, but it also means for people who are maybe of different persuasions politically, connecting with their local, you know, even becoming a delegate at the DNC, something I wouldn't do in 1,000 years, and my mind isn't worth my time. But for other people, that might be how they connect with politics.
Look, taking over your local chapter of your local party is very powerful politically. You have to sit through a lot of really shitty meetings, but like, you show up to enough of those meetings, you could be running the place within a couple of years.
Yeah, or getting involved with your local abortion access campaign, or or a host of things, but still identifying broadly as being on the left or being part of an egalitarian current. And a current that basically says we don't want a world where people get by and get ahead through bullying, or where we allow people to, you know, achieve exalted positions by being bullied. You know, we want a world in which ordinary people can, you know, work hard and be able to take care of themselves and their families. And to me, like, Trump embodies, you know, the very worst of Americans. You know, he one is, like, personally, you know, pretty detestable. Even though he's occasionally funny, we could acknowledge. You know, he's someone who just constantly brags about being a bully, you know, and his version of deal making is zero sum. Whereas I think our vision for the United States, for the world, is a very positive sum vision of expanding justice and expanding prosperity and the world being a better place. And I think that's a message that 60% of the United States and 60% of the world can get behind. I don't think we'll ever get a full 100, but I think that appeal for that is far greater than whether DSA, I think we have declined a bit, 85,000 or 100,000. Either way, it's a country of 330 million people. So yeah. I think this broad-based movement, in which I think socialists have a really important role to play, connecting, I think, these values, which are really commonly shared, with the idea of struggle. Because struggle means that it's not just we have this nice set of shared values we could all march towards, but there is a small minority of people who do have a vested interest in keeping people divided and keeping everything from our workplaces structured as undemocratically as they are to our tax code written in the way it's written. Yes. You know, and that's I think what liberalism is often missed. This theory of politics and these theories of conflict. So I would love socialism to be a complementary piece of the puzzle, changing liberalism, and then, you know, in turn, if you know, being shaped by the people we're interacting with who aren't socialists. And I think there's really a broad movement that we could build in the here and now.
Yeah, and I've seen that happen. I mean, in the Writers Guild, in the writers' strike. We have, you know, we have 10 to 12,000 members, depending on how you want to count. And, you know, they are genuinely folks from all political persuasions. There are, you know, Republicans and Democrats and all other sorts of folks in the union. But the one thing that almost everyone in the union, 95%, 99% of people in the union agree on is that the bosses are trying to screw us. And then if we fight back, we can win. Right. And so there's people who. I know I disagree with them politically on many things, but, you know, we march together in solidarity and we know that we stand there going, hey, but we're doing this together right now. And that feels more important, more powerful and separate from who we voted for governor or whatever, or, you know, what cable news channel we watch. Like it's a politics that we live rather than simply, you know, identify with and click a button about. And and the fact that so many people responded to it around the country, and with, in my view, the reason our strike went viral nationally was people watched it and said, I want to do that too. I face that in my job. How do I do that in my life? That to me was really evidence. These are ideas and a struggle with a broad appeal if we can fucking figure out how to harness it.
Yeah, I think you proved it through practice, too. Yeah. You had your theory that we can make change. You brought together a diverse coalition to make change, and people saw the results. So now it's going to be easier the next time around. Now, with the Bernie campaign, with all these other struggles, the key is to actually rack up victories and to give people a sense that politics isn't just something I'm going to do for fun when I have free time between the ages of, you know, 18 and 26, you know, the time in our lives where we have for many of us, the most free time, but that it's actually an important route to achieve tangible victories. And it's something that we could continue in various forms throughout our lives. And I think that's the goal of any broad left movement, is to achieve some victories and then add on to the victories.
Well, I feel badly that we have talked for over an hour and I haven't even gotten into your publishing work. So let's end there and tell me a little bit about where people can find the work that you do at The Nation and at Jacobin and, you know, the importance of that work as your final plug and telling us about what you do.
Well, I'm the president of The Nation magazine, which is kind of a ridiculous title, but basically like, the publisher of The Nation.
You're literally it's called The Nation. You're the president. You're the POTUS. You're the PONOTUS. I don't know. There's something in there.
And The Nation's been around since 1865. So it was founded by abolitionists in 1865. It's the longest standing, liberal left publication in this country. It's been generally on the right side of history. All those years, 165 years on questions of war and peace and the like, 159 years. That was pretty bad. My math, I'm still living in the past. In my mind, it's not 2024, but I'm also the founding editor of Jackrabbit Magazine, which is a quarterly magazine. I think for my money, it's the best looking publication in the entire country.
The design is incredible of this magazine. Like, it's like you want to cut the pages out and put them on the wall. I subscribed for 1 year just to get the print product, and it truly is beautiful.
And I'm also working on a few books, but my last one was The Socialist Manifesto, which I'm as I work on my second book now, I'm not sure how I managed to write a book in the past. Like, this is 5-6 years ago, so there were still smartphones and all these distractions, but for some reason it was a lot easier than now.
Well, I look forward to the new book, and thank you so much for coming on the show, Bhaskar. It's been incredible talking to you.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much to Bhaskar Sunkara for coming on the show. I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. If you want to support the show, please head to patreon.com/AdamConover. $5 a month gets you every episode of this show ad-free. You can join our community book club. We have a community Discord. We would love to have you join and hang out with us. For $15 a month, I will read your name at the end of this podcast and put it in the credits of every single one of my video monologues, of which I should have some new ones coming out for you very soon. This week, I want to thank Josh Bial and Mask When You Can, Protect Your Community. Thanks for donating Mask When You Can, Protect Your Community. That's a great way to get me to read an important message on the air. We appreciate you, Mask When You Can, Protect Your Community. I want to thank my producers, Sam Rodman and Tony Wilson, everybody here at HeadGum for making the show possible. You can find me online at adamconover.net. To remind you, I'm going to be in La Jolla, California, San Jose, California, Indianapolis, Indiana. Head to adamconover.net for tickets and tour dates. And until next time, I'll see you on Factually.
That was a HeadGum podcast.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.